funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do the people, places, and things in our lives shape how we see things and what we do? Most of us like to think we have a true self with incorruptible principles and relatively immutable characteristics. And since we believe this about ourselves, it's an easy leap to assume we can know the true nature of other people, even when we encounter them only briefly. But as my guest today will explain, the old saw that what you see is what you get, abbreviated by our friends in IT as WYSIWYG, is not really true for any of us. Sam Summers is professor of psychology at Tufts University. His new book is called Situations Matter: Understanding How Context Transforms Your World. Sam, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me on, Chris.
We should maybe start by defining context here, because as we learn in the book, there is a very broad category of conditions that can affect how we behave and how we perceive the behavior of ourselves and others.
That's right. The argument I'm making in the book is, what about context in general? So who you're with, where you are, what's going on in your world at the time you're having an interaction. Basically, the external explanations for why you might think or behave in a certain way, as opposed to internal forces like your personality type or this idea of sort of stable or immutable character. So we're talking about the external, the context, the situations in which we find ourselves.
It's funny that we don't really recognize this in ourselves, because I think most people have experienced, well, I'm this way with my family, but when I'm with my friends, this part of my personality shows. And we don't think of that as being particularly contradictory, but in some ways it is.
Yeah, we are certainly aware of it at that level, right? And it's actually one of the first questions people often ask about the book. Sure, of course. The situation you're in makes a difference, right? But the point of the book is, we don't grasp just how dramatic that conclusion is and how wide-ranging it is. And we really do think about the people around us in our daily lives in not too different a way than we think about TV characters on sitcoms, these sort of predictable personality types that manifest themselves across different situations. Like you said, what you see is what you get. So-and-so acts a certain way because he or she is that kind of person. And so this power of context is quite often sort of hidden in plain sight right in front of us.
You know, it happened to me on the way into work this morning. I was sitting at a red light behind someone who did not have their left turn signal on, and they flipped it on at the last second, leaving me to wait. And I was thinking, well, this person is stupid and careless and doesn't care that I'm trying to get to work. When it might have been, you know, the best person in the world who just forgot to turn on the light.
Oh, it happens so easily in the car, doesn't it?
I know everybody.
Or even just think about it, because it dawns on me just that, you know, one of the chapters in the book has to do with the whole way in which we view the world in us versus them terms and in groups and intergroup conflict and prejudice and so on. And you just think about when you're behind the wheel, how easy it is to get frustrated, yes, with the other drivers, but the pedestrians who are crossing against the light and all. And then as soon as you park your car and get out and you walk down the street and you start to cross in the crosswalk, within 30 seconds, you're angry at all the drivers because they're not yielding to you in the crosswalk. And it's just so quick that we jump into those different mindsets and don't, and not often enough do we sort of take the objective step back and realize, hey, there's more than the kind of person these other folks are going on here. There's something more interesting structurally and contextually going on.
So it's almost ironic to make this statement, Sam, but nobody likes to think of themselves as particularly conformist. It's something we all conform to, I guess. But clearly there are societal and evolutionary benefits to that. Why are we inclined to follow the crowd in so many situations to the extent that we don't even realize we're following the crowd?
Right, conformity in and of itself is not a bad thing, right? Conformity per se is not a problem. I mean, in many respects, it's a glue that holds our society together. Mm-hmm. That if you think about what it's like to walk down a busy downtown street, I mean, the whole island of Manhattan, if you didn't have conformity and people following certain rules, it would be even more chaotic than it already is, or the busy lunch counter, or just anything you want to get done in the course of your day. Conformity is often a glue that helps hold us together and helps us get things done. But you're right, we don't like that notion, especially in sort of Western cultures. In America, we have this idea of independent free thinkers that we all are, and we brush aside the notion that we might be affected by the other people around us. But it is a tendency that's pretty deeply ingrained in us, and you see time and time again from, you know, well, the use of laugh tracks and sitcoms still, and the idea that the reactions that debate audiences are having to the political candidates now as they say things and the booing and the cheering, we dismiss those as being irrelevant and not affecting how we privately think about things. But the data suggests the contrary. We are quite often shaped and influenced by the people around us.
Hmm. Why do we have so many stories of large groups of people being almost paralyzed in situations where an individual might need help?
It's something about that, it's several things about being in a crowd really change who you are. We are different people in a crowd than we are by ourselves. Mm. And it's really easy to read those stories about, you know, the tourist who passes out in the subway and no one does anything for hours and he rides around semi-conscious or dead and no one does anything, or the screams that go unanswered and an attack in a public place, and to read those stories and think what terrible, callously indifferent people those individuals must have been. But it's just so easy to lose sight of the power of being in that crowd. When you're in a crowd, you just don't notice things as much, right? When there's a lot of people around, you put on those blinders and you get on the subway and you just tend to your own business and your own needs to get to the next place. And when you're in a crowd, you use the other people around you as guideposts for figuring out what's going on. And when you look around and none of the other passengers on the subway seem concerned about this guy who's passed out, you figure they all know something that I don't know. This guy's always on the subway and he's taking a nap, or he was okay 10 minutes ago and he must still be fine now. Or even just the idea that in a crowded movie theater, you're hoping someone else is going to stand up and, you know, take one for the team and go tell them that the film went out of focus. And so you're letting that responsibility diffuse to other people. Because we don't notice it, because we don't interpret the events as emergencies, because we don't accept responsibility personally, being in a crowd has all those kinds of effects on us and really does change our tendencies in terms of how we're going to behave.
And I guess the dynamic moves the other direction as well. If one person, you know, three paces ahead of us does step in to help that stranger in trouble, then a crowd of people forms around him or her.
Yeah, that's the hard thing, right? It's to be that first person through the door, the first break in the levee of inaction, if you will. Because once that happens, once someone changes the precedent for what's acceptable behavior, quickly other people's behavior will follow suit. And I interview in the book Cameron Hughes, who's a professional sports fan and gets paid to go to sports arenas and basically act like a crazily enthusiastic fan and get the crowd all riled up. And because he's doing the hard part, he's the one who's sort of making a fool of himself first, and then it becomes easier for everyone else to follow suit. And so that very much is the case.
It's funny about that, too, because I'm not ever really inclined to participate in the wave, but I don't want to spoil things for everybody else if the rest of the people around me are doing it.
Oh, I'm very anti-wave. I read the book. I don't do it. I'm not arguing by any means that it's a dramatically impressive form of civil disobedience. Like, I'm not a latter-day Gandhi by any means, but it's just my one way to try to reassert some independence in that scene, because it is a total conformity fest. I mean, that's what the wave is, and, you know, there's nothing wrong with it, obviously. But I do think we all have our own little strategies for here and there for reasserting our own independence, whether it's just, you know, making sure to touch that plate after the waiter's told you it's hot, be careful, just to prove, oh, it's not so bad. Or ordering the spicy dish that the waitress at the ethnic restaurant suggests might be too spicy for someone like you. So I think we do those things. But for the most part, conformity is, it's a pretty basic part of our daily functioning.
And we don't get the fact that it is also very culturally dependent. For example, in this country, a standing ovation after virtually any live performance has become almost a requirement. And I am told that in Europe, this is not the case. You get a standing ovation still exclusively only for things that are really extraordinary.
Oh, that's interesting. Good for them, because I'm a big opponent of the standing ovation for the pedestrian performance. You can't watch the State of the Union address. It's like 47 different standing ovations. And there are these sort of learned cultural ways that we interact with each other that become very interesting when you do go to travel and get exposed to other cultures. I think that's one of the experiences that makes context more salient for us, right? When we go abroad and we see that the norms are very different, that while, you know, we would maintain a certain personal distance in having a conversation with a stranger here, in this culture they do it very differently and so on. And then you come back home and you realize all of those unwritten rules that are in place here that you don't give much thought to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to realize that maybe it's not just that culture that is so odd, but maybe we as Americans are so odd.
Absolutely. Yeah, we have, I mean, you think about the different, we have different personal space distances. Mm-hmm. There's the stranger, the person you never met, there's the close friend, there's the ATM distance where you stand like 30 steps behind someone so they don't think you're trying to remember their numbers. And some of the strange things that we do that we accept as just par for the course. I mean, another example I think that is illustrative in my mind is this idea of, you know, we often, the house we grow up in, for example, doesn't seem that unusual to us. It's just what we know of as our home. And then you go to college, you come back for Thanksgiving or what have you, and you realize my house has certain smells to it and certain sounds to it in a way I never noticed before, and I noticed it in everyone else's house, and now I realize that mine has that too. And again, we get so caught up in the routine of the familiar environments we're in that we don't often sense exactly what that environment is like.
Let's talk about the influence of gender on behavior. This is in some ways a sort of chicken and egg question, because right from birth, we are essentially being told what it means to be male or what it means to be female.
Yeah, newborn parents, within minutes of their children being born, use different adjectives to describe little boys versus little girls. And you know, the argument I make in the book is I'm not suggesting that there's no biological basis to gender difference.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy. I mean, clearly there are biological differences between the sexes. But I think what we do is we overestimate the importance of that, or we put too much stock in that explanation. We assume we see some sort of generalizable sex difference, and our knee-jerk response is, well, that's biology. That's the way that men and women are wired. You know,
mm-hmm.
Men are from Mars and women are from Venus. And as I talk about in the book, in study after study in different domains, whether math skill or spatial skill or aggression or mate preference in a romantic sense, you find that these sex differences are surprisingly context-dependent as well.
So even when kids are small, we might take them to the toy store and our son picks up a doll and we say, well, that is a nice doll, thinking, well, look what an open-minded parent I am. But then we say, and look over there are the trucks.
Right, and the toy stores are still labeling the different aisles as boys' toys versus girls' toys. And, you know, there's the viral video from just a couple of weeks ago of Riley, the 4-year-old girl, who's railing against all the pink toys she's forced to deal with on a regular basis. And if we don't think about those things overtly, you know, sometimes they sneak up on you. We went through the drive-thru. I have two daughters. We went through the drive-thru not long ago, and they ask you what gender your kid is, boy or girl, when you
yeah.
order a Happy Meal, because they want to know what toy to give them, the appropriate toy. And so we have these gendered messages everywhere. Even those of us who are trying to be conscious of that and trying to behave and treat our children in gender egalitarian ways, those messages are pretty much pervasive.
And it's a tough question in some ways, because on the one hand, I mean, I don't want my children to feel limited one way or another by their gender, and I have both daughters and sons. But on the other hand, there is some socialization that, you know, when they get to school and you know, your son is wearing a pink shirt or your daughter is wearing combat boots, they will be made fun of.
Yeah, and I'm certainly not suggesting that if you have a child who's behaving in these quote-unquote gendered ways, there's something wrong. There's nothing. If your daughters like to play with dolls and princesses and unicorns, great. I mean, if your sons like to play with G.I. Joes and aggressive toys, you know, that's fine. But what I'm suggesting is I think too often we say, well, that's biology. You know, it just sort of drove them to that. And we don't even put them in the situation where, you know, they might very well encounter these other options. I remember my older daughter being just a couple months old on an airplane flight for the first time wearing an airplane sort of Wright Brothers-like onesie with all these little biplanes on it, and people saying, how old is your son? And
mm-hmm.
you'd say, actually, she's, you know, 4 months old. And they'd be shocked. They'd say, whoa, well, but it's airplanes. Which, if you think about it, it's a crazy remark to make, but you understand, right, airplanes, that would be boys. Why that would be boys is a better question, right? I mean,
yeah.
What's biologically driving boys to airplanes? I don't know.
Talk about this. Simply being told that a test has been adjusted so that the genders will perform the same can allow women to perform better on a test that has not been changed at all.
So, right. So there's this pretty well-known finding that often standardized math tests, if you even among high-achieving men and women, you'll see that women will underperform. They will not perform as well as the men will, given the expectations you should have based on their grades and previous performance and what have you. But it's easy to chalk that up to a, well, girls aren't good at math kind of explanation. However, if you give them the exact same standardized math test and you say to them, this is a test that previous research has validated as being free from gender bias, suddenly that difference between the men and the women taking the test goes away. It shrinks, if not goes away altogether. And other little tweaks to context, like having men and women take a test in a single gender room as opposed to a co-ed room, can allow that gender difference to shrink, if not go away. And so this notion that somehow men are hardwired for math and women aren't, that's hard to reconcile with this idea that just telling them something different about the nature of the test could change their performance on it.
Sam Summers is my guest. He's professor of psychology at Tufts University and author of the new book, Situations Matter, Understanding How Context Transforms Your World. We've got phone lines open now for your questions at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Sam Summers. He's professor of psychology at Tufts University and author of the new book, Situations Matter, Understanding How Context Transforms Your World. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So, Sam, we touched earlier on how one's presence in a crowd can lead one to sort of bypass someone in trouble. The other really disturbing crowd mentality is the fact that, you know, we can see people from afar and wonder, how in the world could our ancestors have been blatantly racist? How could an entire generation of young Germans have been convinced to carry out the Holocaust for Hitler and his cronies? And we'd like to imagine that we would never, under any circumstances, do those horrific things. We can't necessarily say that for certain.
Yeah, we have this tendency to think about bad behaviors like that and explain them in terms of a bad apple explanation, that there must have been something, well, whether culturally about Germans during World War II or just take military atrocity or Abu Ghraib, there must have been something wrong with those individual soldiers. And I mean, I'm not ruling out those possibilities, and there certainly are cultural explanations that help explain what happened during World War II. But you see, when you look into these episodes time and time again, how surprisingly normal some of the perpetrators wind up being. Not all of them necessarily, but you know, you see this, you know, the phrase, the banality of evil, and this notion that some of the general basic processes and tendencies we demonstrate on a day-to-day basis to go along with crowds, to be influenced by what other people around us say and think, can manifest themselves in some of these darker chapters of human nature as well.
You write about a really interesting sort of reinterpretation of Stanley Milgram's famous experiment that had to do with the authority of the experimenter. Can you remind us of the original experiment and talk about the new one?
Yeah, well, so the Milgram studies were these, and they're fairly well known in many circles, these famous demonstrations of the power of authority. And, you know, they brought people into this laboratory at Yale, and supposedly was a study about the effects of punishment on learning, and through a random drawing that was actually rigged, you are the teacher who's reading off these word pairs to another participant who's the learner in another room, and every time he gets an answer wrong, you're supposed to give him a shock and move up the shock panel incrementally. In reality, no shocks are being administered, but what winds up happening is somewhere in the neighborhood of, in some versions of the study, 65% of people go all the way to the end of the shock panel, giving potentially, ostensibly lethal dosages of shock to this guy who's in the next room pounding on the wall and saying he wants to get out. And the only real motivating force or coercion on them is just this calm guy in a laboratory, white laboratory coat, who says it's essential for the experiment to continue. You must go on. And so that subtle prompt of authority is enough to get people to engage in a behavior that they know is problematic and wrong.
Yeah, and then it was redone, and they tried it the original way, and then with an experimenter, someone carrying out ostensibly the experiment, not wearing a lab coat, but wearing like what a tracksuit or whatever, casual clothes.
And so Milgram winds up doing variations on this study, right, where you change whether the individual is wearing a white lab coat or not, or you change whether this is taking place at Yale University or just some learning center in New Haven, Connecticut instead. And so these subtle aspects of context make a difference. They do. You are much more likely to go along with the guy who's wearing a lab coat and has that presumed level of authority, and you are more likely to go along with this in a certain set of circumstances than a university campus. And so there are these subtle variations that lead to differences in how people behave. The general finding remains, though, that these ordinary people selected for no reason other than that they were willing to be in a study and, again, psychologically were normal individuals, do things that if you asked most people hypothetically, would anyone ever, you know, in this situation give a 450-volt shock to someone else in the course of a research study, you know, most people say absolutely not, unless you were a psychopath, no way. And you find these ordinary people, good humor men and school teachers, as Milgram referred to them, behaving in this way that most of us would assume that only a select few madmen would do.
And it really forces us to question the tiny cues that we take from people based on things like their appearance. I mean, I think we've all had the experience of walking into the same store in, you know, weekend clothes as opposed to a business suit and getting a very different kind of attention from the staff, regardless of what's in our wallets.
Yeah, we form impressions of people very quickly. We do it based on a variety of characteristics, physical, dress, the way they speak, age, and down the line. We do it very quickly, even though we sometimes, maybe even often, deny that we do. But anyone who's had that experience, certainly, of shopping while dressed in one outfit versus another, or what have you, can attest to that fact that we are making snap judgments about people on a very quick basis. We can change them with time and with effort and motivation, but they can persevere and they can be really influential in how we interact with each other.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Sam Summers is on the line. His new book is called Situations Matter, Understanding How Context Transforms Your World. We'll go to the phones first now to speak with Tim in Dallas. Hello, Tim.
Hey there. Thank you for an awesome topic. I just kind of wanted to relate my own personal experiences with regard to this. What I'm hearing is it sounds like a very herd mentality, you know, when it comes to a lot of the social norms that we find ourselves in. I have a tween. And so obviously she is already being pounded with the idea and the practice of cliques and being in a group, feeling like fitting in, not wanting to appear different or weird or strange. But at the same time, we've taught our kids and continue to teach our kids the idea of individuality. And, you know, in practice, when we're sitting at the dinner table and talking about these things, they make sense. You know, my kid gets it. She's fired up. She, you know, is ready to take on the world, if you will, in terms of her individuality. And then she comes home at the end of the day after a certain day with tears in her eyes saying, well, my individuality got me basically kicked out of my clique. And I was called names, or I was made fun of and spoken of as being differently, or being different rather. So, you know, I wonder if a lot of what ends up forming our norms as adults isn't made very clear and concrete at these points in our lives where it's really possible to make a difference in terms of how we interact with each other, being individuals from this age.
What do you think, Sam?
Yeah, it's obviously adolescence and junior high school. I mean, if you want an example of the power of norms and conformity in your daily life and the way you think about yourself, you know, you don't have to think much further back than that. I mean, that's the critical time where we can all sort of share the stories about. Because you're right, in the abstract, in principle, it's easy to say, absolutely, right? I'm an independent free thinker who does what I want. I value that sort of independence. But man, it's really hard. I mean, the power of conformity and of expectation and what others around you are expecting you to do, I mean, it's almost palpable in some of these situations. And, you know, there's research now that suggests that, you know, the experience of being rejected, of being ostracized from a group, it activates the same centers of activation in the brain that physical pain does. I mean, it can literally be physically painful to be ostracized from a group in that way. And so that's what you're up against, right? And so I think as parents, you certainly have to keep, you know, preaching that story about individuality and independence and, you know, be your own person. But you have to be practical and recognize that the reality of the situation in which our kids and ourselves, for that matter, even as adults, that we encounter, man, it's easier said than done.
So, you know, there was a story a couple of weeks ago on NPR that I am clinging to like it's the most important thing in the world. I can't remember where it was originally published, but it talked about adolescents who argue with their parents are, in fact, better prepared to argue and stand up for themselves. Yeah. With their peers. First of all, I pray that that is true. But the question there is, should we create a climate in which it's okay? I mean, do we have to sacrifice a little bit of control at home in order to allow our kids some autonomy out in the world?
It's an interesting. I read the same article, and my kids aren't quite there yet, but I have the same wishful thinking that you do about it. And it's obviously the environment we create for our children is one of those incredibly important and formative contexts that they are going to grow up in. And of course, there's also research that suggests at some level it's out of our hands. I mean, their real immediate context or their friends at school and the other peer groups that they're in. But there are things that we need to think about as parents, certainly about the context we want to create for our children. At the same time, we recognize that some of this is really out of our hands. And even by a young age, their formative influences are quite often not us.
Let's talk about falling in love. You have said that one of the things that your undergraduate students moan and groan and deny is the reality that no matter where you live, no matter what you're up to, you are likely to find at least a few people that you might fall in love with.
Yeah, I've gotten booed before for suggesting that the whole idea of the one soulmate out there that you have to find might not bear scrutiny when you look at it more empirically. It is the case, and again, I know a lot of people don't like to think about attraction and relationships this way, but you just think about how different your close circle or maybe your history of intimate relationships would be if you had grown up in a different neighborhood or gone to a different college or joined a different gym or worked in a different office. I'm not suggesting that's all that there is to our relationships, physical proximity and geography, but it's a huge contextual influence on who it is we cross paths with and who we fall in love with. Even though when you ask people, you know, what are the most important factors in when you fall in love, they say things like, well, there's certain physical characteristics they list or personality traits and characteristics. And I understand that those play a role, certainly, but it is the case that the context in which we find ourselves, just simple physical proximity and geography, plays an enormous role in our most intimate of thoughts and preferences.
And you can find that really depressing, or you can say, well, it's great because there are a lot of fish in the sea.
I would argue it's an optimistic take. My wife does not care for that argument.
Well, she's your wife.
But I'm being sincere. I'm not being disingenuous. I actually think it's liberating, this idea that, you know, you're going to grow up in a small town in whatever area of the country you grow up in, and you've got to find your soulmate somewhere in that small town. Man, that's a daunting task. Mm-hmm. The odds are stacked against you. And to realize instead that I'm not saying you can fall in love with anyone at the drop of a hat. That's not the argument. But that we are flexible enough so that when we get exposed to multiple people, when we find ourselves in the right circumstances with the right people, there are a wide range of individuals that we can have that initial spark with. That should actually be liberating. I mean, I'm not suggesting the relationships that follow are very real and based on deeper exchanges of information and sharing and down the line. But that initial spark of attraction we can have with multiple people, that should actually be liberating as opposed to worrying that the internet dating site is not giving you the right compatibility survey results or that Mr. or Mrs. Right might be out of the country for the next couple of years and you're never going to find them. I would argue this is a much more realistic but also more liberating take on how we fall for other people.
And then, Sam, to what extent do the life partners we end up with, whether forever or for part of forever, affect who we become over those years together?
Well, that you do. There is interesting body of research on romantic relationships in general. It's an area, again, love and relationships is something that we think about in these mystical or inscrutable terms, but they're actually behavioral scientists who study questions like this. And for example, the idea that when you're with someone for a long period of time, the extent to which your version of yourself or your view of your self-concept and their version view of their self-concept become intertwined and so on down the line. It's actually sort of really interesting body of research you can actually study scientifically.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Philip in Denton. Hi, Philip.
Hey. Hi.
Hi.
You got me with two comments now. I had only one, but two observations and then a question. I'll be very quick, of course.
Thank you.
First off, that last discussion seems to corroborate the studies that I have seen about arranged marriages, where those folks tend to say that they're just as happy as anybody else. And, of course, the divorce rates for arranged marriages, in fact, seems to be a great deal less than what it is for those of us that search for our life partners and soulmates.
I do think those are interesting parallels. Yes, absolutely. I think that when you read those kinds of data, it does speak to this idea that we are pretty flexible in many respects. I'm not advocating that we shift to an exclusively arranged marriage situation, but I think that is interestingly consistent with this viewpoint, yeah.
If you now, Philip, could just, excuse me, Philip, if you could go to, we do not have Philip on the line right now. Let's go to Nancy in Dallas. Hello, Nancy.
Hi. I've been referred to often as someone that marches to the tune of a different drummer, and I was proud of that for many years. I grew up in a very tumultuous home, and I learned to take care of myself. And but I am the sort of a person that cannot conform to the crowd. I cannot work for a corporation and that sort of thing. I'm not I don't just fall in with what everybody else is doing. And so I have found that it does not serve me well to be different than everybody else.
Well, let's talk about that. What do you think about that, Sam?
It's tough because on the one hand, I want to say I hear what she's saying. Absolutely, it's everyone's different. Everyone has their own personality, and we all have different tendencies and propensities. I have people make an argument along those lines of, well, I'm not one of these people who goes along with the crowd. I sort of think for myself, and in fact, it seems like more often than not, most people say that. So at that level, it becomes hard to rationalize or to reconcile with the data. But I think her point about that there are costs to that as well socially, I think it's consistent with what our first caller was talking about with his adolescent daughter. There are certainly costs to not conforming ever. I'm not suggesting that we always want to toe the line and go along with what the crowd does, but that is the power of the crowd, right? That there are usually consequences to going against what's expected of you. I mean, there are entire media empires that have been built on taking advantage of that idea, right? You watch Seinfeld or Curb Your Enthusiasm and those sort of Larry David take on human behavior, and that's a show all about, here's what happens when you don't go along with the norms and expectation. Here are the problems, the funny ones from his perspective, but the problems that ensue. So I understand what she's saying from that standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, so many Seinfelds and so many Curb Your Enthusiasm episodes are all about what happens if you challenge an unwritten rule.
Oh, that's what the show's about. I mean, I say this to you also as a professor with a poster of Kramer up in his office right now talking to you, but I mean, that's what that show's about. It's not a show about nothing. It's a show about the unwritten rules that guide our daily behavior. It's a show about norms and what happens if you at what point can you break up with someone over the phone versus in person, and at what point is it inappropriate to take a call waiting when it comes in versus not, and exploring what the costs of violating those unwritten rules might be.
And in almost every case on both of those shows, when you break the rule, you lose.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's because there are consequences, right? And again, if you think about it, there are nonconformists and there are folks who have gone against the grain of what's expected of them that have helped make our society great. I mean, we celebrate those individuals in this culture, like the Steve Jobs and the others who sort of, and the Bill Gates for that matter, who have done their own thing and have innovated and changed the world. But that is at some level an exception to a rule that's hard to do, and there's a great risk reward involved with that, because certainly there's also, for every Steve Jobs, dozens and dozens of people who tried to innovate and didn't have that kind of success. And so that's the challenge, is that there are these consequences to going against what's expected of you or the norms.
Sam Summers is my guest this hour. He's professor of psychology at Tufts University. His new book is called Situations Matter: Understanding How Context Transforms Your World. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Sam Summers is my guest. He's professor of psychology at Tufts University and author of the book Situations Matter: Understanding How Context Transforms Your World. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Sam, as we discussed earlier, the situation, the context can play a role in who we fall in love with. It can also play a role in who we decide we hate, as in the case of something like racism.
That's right. I mentioned earlier how easy it is at some level to push us into this us versus them way of seeing the world, like when you go from being a pedestrian to a driver or vice versa. The same, unfortunately, goes for more important group distinctions like race and ethnicity or gender or sexual orientation or what have you. Those are cues that we pick up when we meet with someone. We pick up on those within milliseconds. We're registering those categories within 150, 200 milliseconds, so less than a quarter of a second. We pick up on those distinctions, and it does color and influence the way that we interact with each other.
So why, for example, would we you know, instantly decide that someone who didn't look like us must be part of the out-group?
Well, what we do is we see the world around us in categories. We do this with objects. At a young age, we learn that, you know, that's furniture, and those are fruits and vegetables, and those are birds, and so on. And we actually do the same thing with people, even though we often deny that's the case. And when we categorize people the way we do with objects, we tend to do with people what we do with objects, which is assume that the people who go together in a certain group share distinct, you know, characteristics and tendencies. And while they may very well share some tendencies, we exaggerate it. So we exaggerate the similarities between groups and the differences, similarities within groups and differences between groups. It's not that we're hopelessly at the mercy of this categorization process. We can, those of us, as many of us are, who would like to see ourselves and actually be fair-minded individuals, can do that with effort and in the right circumstances. But those associations we have between the group someone is in and the characteristics they have, those are pretty prominent in the way we interact with each other.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Alina in Fort Worth. Hi, Alina.
Hi, nice to talk to you.
You too.
I just had a quick question. I was wondering what your impressions of cultural backgrounds come into the context of a person. My father escaped the Cultural Revolution in China. He is a big fan of conformity. And that goes against the grain of my Americanism and wanting to, you know, be a nonconformist. And I'm always struggling with him at home. But then at the same time, his conformity sneaks into me. And I'm always wondering, is this appropriate? What will people say or think?
It's culture at that level is a really interesting form of context. I talk a little bit in the book, and of course, when you talk about cultural differences, you're always running the risk of overgeneralizing. So I want to be clear that I'm not suggesting all people from one culture are like this and all from another. I know you weren't either. But there are these findings that indeed collectivism and sensing your role and how you fit in with others around you is more important in some cultures, like many cultures in Asia. And in our in Western, quote-unquote, Western society, in the U.S., for example, we do value individualism and independence. And so you can certainly see how someone raised with parents who are from both of those cultures or who've come from one culture to another would get those mixed models and would sense that sort of tension. What's really interesting is that people who have that sort of bicultural experience, depending on what situation you're in, one versus another of those identities can be activated. So when you're reminded of maybe your parents' Asian background and that collectivist mentality, you may be more likely to behave and engage in the world around you in that manner. When you're reminded of this American mentality, whether it's through an American flag or whatever the case may be, you're more likely to exhibit that mentality that's associated with the United States. But that cultural level of analysis is a good example of how powerful context can be.
I love the example that there is in this country, the expression, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. And it is, I think, in Japan, where people say about the same sorts of situations, the nail that's sticking out is the one that gets hammered down.
Yeah. And again, you know, of course, it's not that there's no such thing as independent thought in Japan. I'm not suggesting that by any means.
Sure.
Certainly there's, as we talked about, there's conformity that goes on in the United States. But you do see these different cultural models of how the world is viewed. And I can give the other example. I think a lot of people remember the opening ceremonies at the Beijing Olympics, where you had 2008 drummers in complete synchrony. And it was just mind blowing to many of us who were watching this. You contrast that with, you know, what we do at our opening ceremonies here in the West is we trot Celine Dion out there by herself to sing. So, you know, again, overgeneralizations are a concern. You don't want to go there. But there are these very interesting differences in the cultural view of the self, of each other, how we're supposed to fit in with each other, and so on.
So can we put ourselves in situations that are sort of positive context that would maybe inspire us to do things that are creative or beneficial to us in some way?
Absolutely. I mean, that's really what the book is about. I mean, I argue from the beginning of the book, it's not a self-help book. It's not about necessarily being a better person, per se. It's really about being a more effective person. And so understanding the real factors that shape how people think and act and behave with one another. And so once you get a better sense of that, of the ways in which context shapes our thoughts and our behaviors and our instincts, you become better able to predict other people's behavior and understand where other people are coming from. And that certainly is a goal that many of us have in our professional as well as personal lives. And yeah, if you just take the whole idea of crowds. When you get a sense of the factors that lead to a herd mentality or that might lead to crowd-based apathy, you become better at resisting them if you want to. The chapter I have on crowds sort of ends with advice of trying to break through that apathy that is there in a crowd. If you need someone's help and you're worried about the crowd leading them to be indifference, well, Bob Cialdini, a famous social psychologist, had this advice. What you do is you say, instead of yelling help or, you know, someone, I need some assistance, you point to someone. You say, you, guy in the blue coat, I'm having a heart attack. Call 911. I need assistance. And that seems crazy, but sometimes that's what you have to do to break through that crowd mentality to actually get the outcome you want. And it's not just emergencies. It's all down the line of trying to get people to, you know, sort of respond in the ways you're hoping they're going to respond, and to get the most out of the daily social interactions that we have in our regular life.
Yeah, it's funny. If you take a CPR class, or at least years ago when I took the last one I took, they say if you're the person giving CPR and you need someone to call 911 and there's a crowd of onlookers, you point to one person and do the same thing.
Yeah, and you know, it doesn't have to be an emergency. When you want someone to help you at the office, the mass email that goes out to 25 people probably not as effective as saying, you know, hey, John, I could really use your help on this.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's really easy, we all do it, to get that mass email and look at the list of recipients and say, oh, well, there's plenty of people on that list. I'm not going to be the one who does this. And so, yeah, when it comes to getting assistance, whether for the really important, the mundane to the sublime versions of human assistance, that's good strategy.
Perhaps in an offline conversation, we can talk about public radio fundraising appeals.
Yeah, well, I think it's applicable, right? And you know who's great at this stuff? Who's great at this stuff at manipulating and managing situations are fundraisers and salespeople and marketing. I mean, that's what marketing and advertising, that's really what it is. It's pulling the strings of context to make the same product look more appealing than it would otherwise. And so you're absolutely right.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Mark on the line in Arlington. Hello, Mark.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well.
Neat show. May I ask, I'm born in 66, 84, high school grad, saw the introduction of the computer age. Me and my buddies would sit in the computer starter for ages, figured out, great toy, had to figure out how to play with it. The ladies generally would rather slam their hand in the car door than sit and tinker with it. And in turn, for some reason, the men seemed to take over the computer science industry generally. You said earlier that girls and boys don't have specific skill sets based on gender. What's your explanation in this situation?
It's a good question, right? And so whether that comes out of what I think is a hard sell to me is to argue, well, you know what, men, it's testosterone. Men wants testosterone makes you want to go take a computer apart and figure out how it works. Now, I mean, I think what makes more sense to me are the arguments of, well, from a young age, as boys, you're encouraged to go out there and play with the model cars and take it apart and figure out how it works and use the walkie-talkies and just you get different presence and are exposed to different situations than you are as a young girl in the society. I mean, some of the differences, for example, in spatial skill, in how people navigate unfamiliar territory or rotate shapes in their head, men tend to be better at that than women. Just that's what the data tell us. But what's interesting is what seems to account for a lot of that difference is just video game experience, because men also are spending so much more time playing video games when they're kids. If you train women on video games, these first-person shooter games, you're navigating unfamiliar territory, suddenly that gender gap shrinks dramatically. And so things we might not think about as being important differences in the context we're exposed to as boys and girls, as men and women, I think do play out later on in life as well.
So what does all this mean in terms of our ability to be good judges of character? It's another one of those things that every one of us thinks we're exceptionally good at judging character, and obviously that cannot be true.
Well, what I would argue is that we have to refrain from jumping to conclusions. That what we do is we make this knee-jerk, this quick jump to, aha, I know what kind of person that is. And then, you know, you read the newspaper article about, well, this guy couldn't have done the things he's accused of because I know him and he wouldn't hurt a fly. We're shocked. He seems so normal, and then he's capable of all these behaviors. I think that we are overconfident in our abilities to determine someone's personality or character. I think what helps is to force yourself to take a step back and think, well, what's going on in this context? You know, what's going on in this situation? I always see my physician in the same place, at the doctor's office, where she's an expert and she knows everything and she knows how to handle everything. Maybe I shouldn't be shocked to see her on the weekend struggling to read a map or parallel park. I mean, it's normal that she would have those kind of difficulties like anyone else might have, and it's not realistic to expect she's always a genius or a savant across every discipline in her life. And so I think forcing ourselves to take a step back and to not react emotionally and have that knee-jerk jump to conclusions about personality. I think that's a big, important first step.
Yeah, and by the same token, we might assume somebody we've had a conflict with or who hasn't pleased us in a business situation is a terrible person or completely inept, and that may not be true.
Yeah, it's so easy. Think about any customer service example. I mean, I actually start the book with a customer service example because we have those. We have so many of us have the bad customer service stories, and it's so easy to think about, you know, what a jerk this person is, what a bully they are. They're sort of being a totalitarian dictator of their own little world and getting angry and stomping off and not getting anything and out of the interaction. When you take a step back and when you try to assess the entire context in which this interaction is going on and figure out what the procedures are and what the loopholes may be, those conversations go a whole lot better as well.
Let's go to the phones one more time. We'll speak with Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. I was wondering, I was reading online that some researcher basically came out and said that all of us fit on sort of an autism scale. How does this various levels of autism that exist in the human equation affect our interactions, our relationships, and the people we tend to hang around with? Thank you.
That's an interesting question, and I'm not an autism expert by any means. What I will say is that, you know, to the extent that when you think about autism, you're talking about, in many respects, picking up on social cues and some of those social interaction style types of behaviors, that is really at some level what I'm arguing about in the book here, is that what we could all benefit from is an increased ability to step back and get a sense of that context that's lurking right there in plain sight and the ways in which the situations that we're in shape how other people around us are reacting. And I think the more sensitive and attuned we are to what's really going on in the conversations we have with other people, the more effective we become in a variety of domains. So I think that's, to me at least, what the potential relevance might be there.
Can you talk a little bit about what it takes for the scientists who are carrying out the kinds of experiments you write about in this book to ensure that their own personal biases, perceptions, contexts don't find their way into the results of the studies?
Oh, scientists are never biased, though. No, you're right. I mean, that's the challenge. Here you are, you're studying human nature, and not necessarily its limitations, but the hidden forces maybe that shape human behavior and that affect our thoughts in the ways we're not always expecting. And then there you are as a human being doing that research, right? And so I do think you have to be acutely aware of those issues. It's why it's so important in science that you get multiple research findings from multiple researchers using multiple different procedures and so on. There's no perfect study. There's no one perfect study. And sometimes we get caught up in trying to find what that might be. But I think that, to me, is really part of the fascination of doing this, because we're studying something, daily human life, something that we all talk about around the water cooler or at the dining room table or the boardroom table or what have you, and trying to do it in a scientific way as well. And to me, that was sort of what's fun about the book, is you've got behavioral science, but you've also got the pop culture in it and the personal anecdote and humor and so on, because I think that's what the human existence is, and I think that's how we conduct that level of analysis. But I think you've hit it on the head. I think that it's a challenge and an irony of being a human being studying the true nature of human nature.
And I guess it is true what our grandmothers told us, that we ultimately often get judged by the company we keep.
It's true. And that, yeah, that maybe that's the better moral of the book, is that the grandmothers are quite often correct about human nature. But yeah, it's who we are with and who's around us. It's not just that, you know, that we listen to them and that they tell us certain things. They change who we are. They shape how we see ourselves and in ways that we're not willing to admit or maybe don't ever even recognize. They change our deepest instincts and behavioral tendencies.
Sam Summers is professor of psychology at Tufts University. His new book is called Situations Matter: Understanding How Context Transforms Your World. Sam, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thanks a lot for having me, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.